Three agencies have been working the Crystal Rogers case for years, executing search warrants, interviewing witnesses and possible suspects, and presenting evidence to grand juries in search of indictments. The FBI, Kentucky State Police, and Nelson County Sheriff have worked hand in hand on the investigation, with the state and federal agencies taking the lead in recent years. For much of the last decade, the only names we knew about as persons of interest in the case were Brooks Hauck and his brother Nick Hauck. But that changed in 2023, when father and son Steve and Joseph Lawson were arrested and charged in her case. The arrest came after dozens of police interviews, interviews attorneys describe as inappropriate, and in some cases, egregious.
They hollered at him, they yelled at him, they screamed at him, they spit in his face. I watched it on video. He asked me to come in and stop it. We returned several other times for meetings with the Commonwealth. They badgered him, but he cooperated.
I'm Shay McAllister, and this is Bardstown.
Wheels don't fail me now. Let's get out of here somehow.
Court documents filed by the attorney representing Brooks Hauck claim the investigators who brought the case against him lack the evidence needed for a conviction. Attorney Brian Butler wrote this in a recent court filing. The Commonwealth lacks proof that Miss Rogers is deceased. If Miss Rogers is deceased, the Commonwealth can do no more than guess at who killed her, how she died, why she died, and where she died. There is no crime scene, murder weapon, or realistic motive for the alleged crime. The court documents go on to say, desperately needing to solve this case, the Commonwealth sought to mask their evidentiary problems by targeting the Lawsons with the goal of getting either or both to cooperate against Brooks. The intense pressure and astounding promises required to achieve the goal of obtaining the testimony necessary to indict and arrest Brooks is simply unprecedented. What comes next with this testimony is a huge question as we look toward trial. If true, can the prosecutor use it in a trial? And if it is thrown out, how will that impact the prosecutor's case? We took the questions to Nick Mudd, the former prosecutor and current criminal defense attorney who has experience on both sides of the courtroom.
If it's true, it's egregious, and I think it would be upsetting. And if it is true, I foresee the lawyers for the other individuals filing motions to either exclude that testimony or to suppress it as being under duress. For instance, you can't threaten somebody and then they give a statement. Well, that's not considered a truthful statement. That's not going to come in front of a jury. That would be a grounds for, we talked about earlier, getting excluded or suppressed. That would be a good grounds for that. I haven't looked at it all, as I said, but certainly if it's there, that's troubling. And it's concerning in terms of how it could be used as evidence, or even if the judge will allow any of the statements that came after those incidents to be used in the sense of to allow a jury to hear them.
Can you tell how important that testimony might be to this case when you look at the fact that all of these police interviews happened in 2023 with Joseph and Steve? And then Brooks Hauck is arrested that same year. Does that make you think that those interviews are pretty critical to the case?
It does question that they could be very critical. And the reason I say that is because, you know, you and I have discussed the case. We've asked, you know, where's the physical evidence? Because that's what we're waiting on, right? Again, we'll go back to a cold case. We're used to a cold case to having DNA, a gun, a weapon, a body, something else to link somebody with. But here, so far, we've just had statements given by the Lawsons, Steve and Joey Lawson. And so it does lead one to believe that that testimony is critical to the prosecution of Mr. Hauck, based on the timing of everything and the fact that we're 6 months in and none of us have heard any specific physical evidence against Mr. Hauck in this case.
So if it comes out that those things are true, it's as egregious as it looks, it does get taken out of the case. Does that have a big impact on the prosecutor's case here?
Unless there's physical evidence linking Mr. Houck to the crime itself, I'd think it has a substantial impact, very substantial impact.
Brooks Houck's attorney is using the interview tactics as reasoning to keep the trials separate, something Nick Mudd told us last week he doesn't see happening. But Steve Lawson's attorney is using the same situation for a different reason. He has filed a motion to have his client's charges dropped altogether. Here's attorney Ted Lavitt after the most recent court hearing, describing his client's promise of immunity.
At all times, he was promised immunity, in my presence and outside of my presence, before I got involved and after I got involved. And there's no question about that. He said, this is the truth. This is all I know. I can't say what you're wanting me to say. I'm telling you what I know. And he did.
There's this claim of immunity. Can you walk us through that a little bit, this transactional immunity, what that means?
Right. And again, I haven't had the opportunity to review the statements. I've just looked at snippets that were in some of the filings. But generally, if you're offered immunity to talk and then you give a statement, that's it. You have immunity from the state. Now, a federal prosecutor could still pick it up because the state can't bind the federal government, okay? And those, now there are exceptions, but in that, generally, the state can't bind it. But I don't see the feds picking this case up. That being said, for state court, you know, if Mr. Lawson was guaranteed immunity, you know, I don't see how they're going to go forward on him at some point. The government's not allowed to say, hey, we won't prosecute you as long as you talk. And then you talk and they say, well, we don't like what you said, so we're going to change that. That's not how it works.
Well, what does that promise have to look like? Does it have to be on paper? Does it have to be specific words? Can it be as simple as what Shane Young is in these court documents written to have said, which is things like, we want to help you. If you talk to us, we're going to help you. We're not going to get you in trouble for what you tell us today. Things like that. Is that enough?
I believe it is. And I think the court has to look at the context of everything. And certainly the lawyers are good. They're going to make filings regarding that. But the judge has to look at the totality of the circumstances here of what was conveyed, what Mr. Stephen Lawson believed in regards to why he would talk, you know, why he would give a statement at that point. And so, you know, certainly it's up to the court to review all that and make a decision. But the court's going to look at everything and make a decision based on that. There's no magic words here that's going to say, oh, that's it. That's the magic words. A lot of it is looking at the totality of everything that was said, what Mr. Lawson believed, what the prosecutor's intention was here in stating that. But the words themselves certainly do have effect, but there is no magic phrase there. The judge is going to look at everything.
So when you what you have seen, and I know you haven't seen it, none of us have seen it all, but do you think that his attorney, Ted Lavitt, could have a case here to say there was some immunity promised?
At least from what we've seen so far, absolutely. And I expect a lengthy motion from him. I assume he'll be filing.
And when you see, I mean, his most recent motion was either give him the immunity, drop the charges, mm-hmm. or exclude his testimony, right. One or the other. Is that a realistic ask?
I think it is, absolutely. And, you know, I would bet more on the immunity aspect of it based on what I've seen so far. Again, I haven't seen everything. But certainly it's fair to say, look, if you are going to not grant my client immunity and you stated all this, well, it only seems fair to exclude it because he gave that statement, that whatever statement he made that we haven't seen, but he at least talked to the police based on those representations of immunity. And so it only seems proper to exclude it at that point if the immunity itself is not going to be granted.
Brooks Houck was arrested just months after the most recent interrogations with Steve and Joseph Lawson. His attorneys claim the statements from the Lawsons built the case against him. And if that weren't true, he would have been charged in connection to Crystal Rogers' disappearance years ago. It's led to a common question, one we get again and again. Will there be more arrests in this case? Well, of course, without a crystal ball, we can't know for sure. But we wanted to ask Nick, with what he knows about the timing of a case, is it possible they could be eyeing other people to arrest?
I think they could be, but certainly it would be surprising at this point for them to go forward on somebody else unless, again, there was a break. Some sort of physical evidence usually. Now, certainly people could come forward. They could get more witness statements. Somebody could say, hey, I never told anyone this. And then they come forward with something else. So that could happen. But at this, you know, I won't say late in the game because it's still early for a typical murder case, but it is certainly well into the case. And I would be highly surprised if someone else would be brought in at this point if they had evidence to charge them.
Okay, so that leads us to Nicholas Houck. His name has come up in the courtroom. He's already been tied as potentially having some connection to an entirely different murder case, but one that has connections to Crystal, Tommy Ballard, her dad. You've heard about the evidence with the gun testing. The prosecutor saying, we bought a gun from Nicholas Houck. We believe it was used to kill Tommy Ballard. It's matched 4 out of 5 points. Do you know anything about this testing? Can you give us any insight onto what they might be looking at here?
So I can tell you with, it's called a tool mark examination. It's a science that's been around, I think, since around 1908. I've disputed it as a defense lawyer in cases, and I've used it to secure convictions in homicide cases as a prosecutor. What they generally do, they can look at the marks. So generally, the marks on a firearm, every firearm, are unique. Now, there's exceptions, but based on my experience with it, so when a firing pin hits a bullet, or hits, I'm sorry, hits a cartridge, it leaves a mark on there. And they can look at the marks with, if they have a gun, they can test fire the gun and compare the marks and see if they're similar, and there's a certain amount of points they use. Now, there's other things as well. When the ejector on the firearm ejects a shell, assuming that it's a semi-automatic, it can also leave marks that are unique, as well as the barrel. When a bullet is fired and goes down a barrel, and if they recover the projectile or the bullet, it can have marks on there that are unique as well to a firearm. It is often used in homicides throughout, especially in Jefferson County, in shooting cases, to where they can take a shell casing and compare it to that specific firearm and link it back, as well as take a bullet to a shell casing and compare it back as well. So it's called tool and mark firearm identification. And it's certainly, science has been around for over 100 years. Some lawyers dispute it. Some prosecutors heavily rely on it. So that, you know, it's all over the place with the challenges on it. But certainly, at least in courts in Kentucky, it's something that has been accepted now for, I believe, over 100 years.
So to say that they have 4 out of 5 positive matches, what are those results like? Is that a good result? Is that a questionable result?
You know, I'd have to delve back into the science to see how strong the comparisons are. And maybe there's an area that was damaged that they couldn't do a comparison, and so only 4 match. But, you know, it's hard to say without looking at the what's called the bench notes of the examiner. And, you know, if we had the bench notes, we'd be able to kind of look at that and give a better interpretation of what's going on. But, you know, it's difficult to say without looking at that and kind of diving deeper.
What could be the prosecutor's motivation to bring this up in court, to bring up this name of this person who might be tied to this other murder case? Why would he do that?
Well, I think in the context of it, it was within a bond hearing, if I recall. Mm-hmm. And certainly it's just more ammo to try to keep someone in, okay, pending trial.
And so you can say because your brother might be involved in this other case, we need to keep you in jail.
Certainly the defense could object to that and say it's completely irrelevant, and Mr. Butler may have done so. Mm-hmm. But a prosecutor's job is to prosecute, and he's doing the best he can to keep Mr. Houck in custody pending trial.
Would you say it's unusual for a prosecutor to bring up this kind of evidence and drop this kind of bombshell about a completely different case, but then not make the arrest? You know, that was months ago.
Right.
Nick Houck has not been arrested. He hasn't been charged with anything.
It could be, but that being said, in the heat of the moment, things get said all the time. You know, I've certainly had cases to where I'm defending my client and someone says, and his mother threatened the girl, and his sister did this. I don't take much stock always in what is said specifically in court in the heat of the moment. When we're dealing with rhetoric and we're dealing with argument and you got two lawyers going back and forth, it can get tense. Not that it's not a factual statement. It's just that the relevancy of it sometimes can be, sometimes it can be completely irrelevant, but people just say it, or prosecutors do, or defense lawyers, for purposes of trying to win their argument.
So maybe not something to read into too much here.
I wouldn't spend too much time on it at this point in time.
Okay, so we know there, again, hasn't been an arrest in Tommy Ballard's case. Nick certainly isn't arrested. Do you think there's a chance they could be working with Nick behind the scenes? Would they bring him up like that if they were?
You're asking whether the police could be working with him?
And the prosecutor.
And the prosecutor?
Yeah.
I would say that if they were working with him at this point in time, or there was some sort of deal going on, that would have been brought up at this point in court. At this point in the game, I mean, this case has been going on long enough that would have been something that would have been brought up. So I highly doubt that. Again, it's not my case. I'm not prosecuting. Right. There's a very good, competent prosecutor on the case. But I would say at this point in the game, given that it's, you know, almost April, and this case has been going on now for what, maybe 6-7 months, that would have been something disclosed at this point.
Another mention in the courtroom caught our attention. It was this comment from Special Prosecutor Shane Young at Brooks Houck's arraignment.
The Commonwealth is asking this court to consider the defendant and his family's behavior during the grand jury proceedings in this matter. The defendant speaks in his motion about his loving support of his family. I completely agree. They've been supportive. This court and defense counsel are well aware of the sanctity of grand jury proceedings. It's so important the Kentucky Supreme Court gave it its own rule. Grand jury proceedings are secret. In this matter, the defendant's sister, Rhonda McElvoy Houck, brother, Nicholas Houck, mother, Rosemary Houck, brother-in-law, Alex McElvoy, and Rosemary Houck's live-in boyfriend, Larry Mott, all recorded, secretly brought in recorders and recorded the grand jury. I've been practicing here, Your Honor, for 25 years in this state, and I have yet, ever heard of anyone recording a grand jury.
Can you give us some context as to why they're not charging in this case and why even bring it up?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I've never heard of anyone secretly recording grand jury testimony until this case. I'd say it's something that's strongly concerning. However, it's not something we've heard any more about, which I also find that ironic. Mm-hmm. You know, when we first heard about this case, that was front and center of everything. I do think, though, if this case does proceed to trial and actually get trial and goes to a jury, it's something that will probably become an issue again.
So you think we'll see this again?
I think the issue's not dead for sure.
Hear more about it at least.
Yes, ma'am.
Another lingering question, what about the other Bardstown cases? Specifically, Jason Ellis, whose name has come up more than once in court. Here's Prosecutor Shane Young during a February court hearing.
When we received the case, it took us 6 months to go through the discovery, and that included Ellis and Ballard.
Does that tell you that there is a connection there? There's something in that case file putting all three in the same folder?
You know, in my job, I look at only evidence. That's what I'm concerned about. And until I see something that links them specifically, I just wouldn't read too much into that right now. Okay. And people can speculate all they want, but I'm a person that looks at the facts of a case and the evidence of a case, the discovery of a case. And until we see that, I just don't think it would be proper at this point to read too much into that.
So the fact that there's one case file doesn't necessarily mean that all three have one thing in common.
Correct. They could be, but you know, that doesn't mean that. I would not read into that unless there is a specific fact of discovery that evidence shows that they're linked together, which we have not seen at this point in time.
There's a lot we'll have to wait to really understand. But before we let him go, we wanted to ask Nick about the key players in the courtroom, the attorneys, the prosecutor, and the judge. He knows most of them.
Brian, I know, went to Notre Dame Law School, so he's a very intelligent guy. Went to one of the best law schools. He certainly worked at the Commonwealth Attorney's Office here. Then he was a federal prosecutor, and he's been in private practice for several years. He's a mentor to tons of young prosecutors. A good majority of the defense bar he's mentored as well, including myself. His former partner is Alex Daythorn, who's now the assistant Commonwealth Attorney here in Jefferson County. They were together for several years, both phenomenal lawyers, and it's always been great to me. I don't know Mr. Lavitt very well. I've seen him in court, so I can't speak on him at all. I will tell you, Kevin Coleman is a friend of mine. I talked to Kevin yesterday. We talked in court for a long time. Kevin is a very good lawyer. He's very unassuming. So what I mean by that is he is very meticulous in going through stuff and will find things that other people don't see. Kevin was a public defender for a while here in Jefferson County, and he's been in private practice for several years now. But he is very intelligent about breaking discovery down in the evidence and making connections and seeing patterns that other people don't see. You know, and then Shane Young is a was a prosecutor here in Louisville. He was a defense lawyer here around the area for several years. So he knows both sides of the game. And then he got elected several years ago to be the Commonwealth Attorney in Hardin, out in E-Town in Hardin County. Shane is a phenomenal prosecutor. I think he's won Prosecutor of the Year several times with the Prosecutor Advisory Council. Very, very diligent man. I will tell you the case we tried was a simple possession case, but you're not going to outwork him. He is a workhorse. And I will tell you, I guarantee he's looked at every single bit of discovery and evidence in this case and probably done so 10 times. And then we have Judge Sims, who I had multiple cases in front of him, always fair, always polite, treated everyone with dignity, both sides, whether prosecution or defense. He's always made intelligent rulings. The last case I'd sat with him, the prosecutor and I got to the eve of trial and we resolved, and he helped us do it. And so, you know, I've obviously great things to say about him. I always think he's made intelligent rulings, very well-reasoned rulings whenever I've been in front of him. You've got intelligent people filing smart motions. You got, you know, a lot of times you'll get either a lazy lawyer, a lazy prosecutor, a lazy defense lawyer, or one outsmarts the other. You got intelligent people all around that are all, everybody in this case that I'm aware of is a workhorse, which means they are going to beat this case and work it and, you know, or I'm sorry, you know, kind of beat it down until they know everything in the case. And so, again, it wouldn't surprise me if it goes to trial. When you get good lawyers and they're digging in and they're working their cases and they believe in what they're doing and they believe in their evidence or lack thereof, certainly that is ripe for a case to go to trial.
Okay, last question for you here. What is at stake? We've got this case that's now in its ninth year unsolved. We're just now getting charges. What is at stake here?
Well, certainly I think for Ms. Rogers' family, it would be closure, right? And certainly, as I said, my heart goes out to them. I know that a trial or certainly a pending case can put a family through agony because they don't know. And certainly anyone that is a victim of a crime or of a victim's family in a homicide, you know, they want justice, but they also want closure. Obviously, for the defense, Mr. Houck is facing the ultimate penalty of really life, not the ultimate, but life in prison, you know, up to life in prison. So, you know, for his attorney, Mr. Butler, the stakes don't get much higher than that, other than a capital murder case, which, as far as I can see, they haven't filed any aggravators in this case to make it a death penalty case. But I would say it's one notch right below that. And certainly for the other lawyers, you know, their charges of their clients are not as serious. But, you know, their client's liberty is in their hands at stake. And anytime, any case that you're defending as a criminal lawyer, you take serious. But certainly when you're in circuit court and you're facing felonies and you're facing going to prison for several years, I mean, the stakes just get ramped up. And with the whole state of Kentucky watching you, it's even more pressure to say, hey, I've got to perform my best. I've got to do everything and I can't leave any stone unturned.
When it comes to motive, evidence, when and where Crystal Rogers died, we will likely have to wait until trial to find out. But there are some elements we'll likely learn sooner, as soon as this summer, including where the high-profile trial will be held, what testimony will or won't be included, and if the charges against all three defendants will stick. We know the Bardstown community will be watching closely, waiting for the next shoe to drop.
This is just the beginning. The information is going to trickle out, and we're going to try to put it together like a big puzzle.
For Crystal Rogers' family, a conclusion to the case can't come soon enough, but they're willing to wait for accurate answers and a conviction.
I just hope the day comes that we can get her remains and bury her, and everybody involved in this pay for it the rest of their lives.
This is the fifth and final episode of Season 4. But as you know, this case is far from finished, and so are we. You can expect additional bonus episodes with new updates as they develop in the courtroom. And as always, keep an eye on my social media. That's the first place I go when I get new information. Bardstown is written by me, Shay McAllister, and edited by chief photojournalist Philip Murrell. The podcast is a WHAS 11 news production. Visit our website, whas11.com, to learn more about the cases we cover. Let's get out.